Yes, she looks like a queen, a warrior, an adversary.
Prince Elian, she says.
Princess Yukiko. She smiles at the use of her real name. Kai stiffens beside me, his resentment growing. Now that my crew is faced with the very woman who manipulated me into giving up my time on the sod, my time and theirs, they can hardly be expected to smile. Swiftly, I nudge Kai before he has a chance to say anything. Who knows how much Princess Yukiko has told her family about her time in Midas? Did she tell them she was the owner of the illustrious Golden Goose? That she traded as much in royal secrets as she did in liquor, gambling her nights away with the wretches of my kingdom? I doubt it. But even if she has, Kai addressing her informally won't go amiss. He may have been a diplomat's son once, but his disinheritance is no secret. Besides, she's a princess, a potential queen. My potential queen. I flinch at the thought, hoping that my bargain with Galena is enough to make my bargain with Yukiko void. I feel the stares of all 100 of my crew on my back. But as much as they want to say to me, there's just as much I want to say to the princess. The deal I want to discuss and the counteroffer I'm desperate to present. Nevertheless, now's not the time. Not with so many prying eyes and pricked ears. I bow in greeting.
Look at you, trying to hide your surprise,
Princess Yukiko says.
There's no reason for it, you know. The hiding or the surprise. Aren't we old friends? Isn't this my home? Where else should I be but with such dear friends and family?
Of course, I say tightly. I'm just surprised by how quickly you made the journey.
Not all ships float, Yukiko says. Some prefer to fly.
Her voice is unduly self-assured, and unlike Lyra, there's nothing I enjoy about her brand of arrogance. I resist the urge to roll my eyes and settle for a curt nod of understanding. The Piggy's airships are some of the best in the Hundred Kingdoms. They vary from the bullets, darting balloons with barely enough room for half a dozen passengers, to lavish ships that are opulent enough to be dubbed floating palaces. They have at least 8 separate rooms and span up to 3 floors, depending on the cargo or, more often than not, the social standing of the passengers. The Piggies have always been on good terms with the Evephrashi, who birth the world's greatest inventions. They're a kingdom at the forefront of nearly every technological triumph, and there's rarely an invention today that can't trace its origin back to the Evephresi. Pegos has been their ally for so long that it doesn't even matter if they exist at opposite ends of the world. There's seldom anything stronger than 2 kingdoms drawn together by a decades-old marriage alliance. It means that Pegos is privy to many of the technological advancements that Evephrashi has, and so they're one of the few kingdoms with the means to confine most of their travel to air rather than sea. For the rest of the 100 kingdoms, airships tend to be unreliable. Malfunctions are not uncommon, and unless the journey spans longer than a month, it's more trouble than it's worth.
You're the princess, Lyra asks.
As much as her contempt for everyone around her usually entertains me, I send Lyra a pointed look, warning her not to say anything out of line. But she either doesn't notice or she doesn't care. I can guess which one is more likely. Yukiko nods.
I didn't realize the prince was recruiting new members for the Sod.
Oh, I'm not a recruit, Lyra says. I'm just here to kill him. She stares pointedly at the princess. And anyone else who gets in my way? Kai makes a poor attempt to muffle the sound of his laughter with the back of his hand. I snap my gaze to Lyra and clench my teeth. Has the cold gone to her head, or is she so used to our rapport that she thinks it can be the same with every royal? I try to catch her attention, but she's fixated on Yukiko. Her eyes are as cold as the wind. She's joking, I say, pushing Lyra behind me. And probably drunk. Lyra scoffs, and I squeeze my hand across her waist to silence her. Pay no attention to my crew, I say, giving the king a blithe smile. When the food runs low, they tend to live off the rum. King Kazu dismisses the comment with a laugh, though it's every bit as precise as his military stance. Beside him, Yukiko eyes my hand on Lyra's waist.
There are more important things to discuss, Kazu says. Come, we must talk at the palace, away from the teeth of our weather. From what my sister has told me, there is a rather interesting bargain to be struck.
After being shown to our guest chambers and given enough food to put Torek's mood to rest, I'm escorted to the Grand Hall. At the request of King Kazu, I'm alone. And yet there are 7 guards who walk in step behind me as the royal concierge leads the way. I took it as a compliment when they came to fetch me from my new chambers, armed to the teeth with spears that looked like they may have actually been made from teeth. It's almost a testament to my reputation that they trust me so little. The Grand Hall hides behind a set of iceberg doors that must be rotated via wheel mechanism. The cogs make an unreasonable amount of noise as they heave the great doors open to reveal the chamber inside. It's not a large space, but everything about it is grand and opulent. Chandeliers drip down in frozen teardrops, and icicles sprout up from the solid ice floor like weeds. I step on it, half expecting to land with my legs in the air, but the surface is surprisingly dry under my feet. The 5 siblings of Pagos eye me from their thrones. Each of them is dressed in black finery that seeps from them like oil. From behind their lavish seats, there is a single window clawed with blue frost. It creeps across the pane like a flower, obscuring the last few minutes of sunshine that could penetrate the cavern.
I trust your rooms are satisfactory, King Kazu says. I must admit, I'm glad your crew is a little more downsized. 100 pirates is enough. I dread to think what having an entire legion in my palace would be like.
A lot of fun, I'd wager. The young Prince Koji murmurs a laugh.
The stories speak for themselves, he says. I'm a little sorry I won't get to experience them firsthand.
Next time, I tell him, I'll bring the whole horde. I turn back to the king. Does our deal still stand?
I don't remember ever making a deal with you, King Kazu says. But my sister seems to think she has the authority to.
He casts an irate glance at Yukiko, but she waves him off with a flick of her eyes as though he's the nuisance. Prince Hiroki leans over to his brother.
She gave him the map, he says. I hope that means we got something equal in value.
You did, I say, and pull the necklace from my pocket. I let it dangle in the air between us, a beautiful drop of blue that dances from the chain, still specked with Lyra's blood. King Kazu's fists tighten around the arms of his throne.
What a thing you present to us so casually, he says. Where did you find it?
The same place I found that prisoner you've got locked away in your dungeons. Prince Hiroki shuffles in his seat, and I stop wondering which of the king's brothers Rycroft was talking about.
The Zafra, King Kazu snarls. Talus Rycroft and his band of damned thieves. I should have known that anything lost would find its way into his hands.
It's not in his hands now, I say, clasping the necklace. It's in mine. Prince Tetsu leans forward with a growl.
You'd do well to hand it over.
Now, brother, the king chuckles. I'm sure that's his plan.
Of course, I say, as soon as the right offer is made. Yukiko's smile is slow and devious.
You have to admire his courage,
she says. King Kazu rises to his feet.
You want entry to our mountain, so you can find the Crystal of Kito, he says. Then what?
Then I give you back your priceless necklace, and when I'm done with it, the crystal too. This is the chance for Pagos to make history as the kingdom who helped destroy the Sirens once and for all. Your family will be remembered as legends.
Legends?
The king's sharp laughter slices the air.
What's to stop me from just taking it from you now?
Once the Crystal of Kito is freed, the Sea Queen will know it, I tell him. And you're a lot of things, Your Highness. But a Siren Killer isn't one of them. If she's going to die, it'll have to be by my hand. Let me climb the mountain, and we can make history together.
It's a perilous journey, the king says, even with our sacred root. What would your father say if I put his son in danger like that? Even if it was for something as noble as saving the world. Furthermore,
he nods toward his sister.
Yukiko traveled all this way, finally returning home after so many years. It seems curious to me that she would do that just because she believed in your cause.
Yukiko eyes me with amusement, taking pleasure in the idea that I might just squirm. As though I'd give any of them the satisfaction. I'm not sure if the king is goading me or if Yukiko really hasn't told him about our engagement, but I know I won't be the first to speak of it.
Of course I didn't, Yukiko says to her brother. I came because I want to be the first one to see it. I want to be there when the Crystal of Kito is finally found.
My jaw tightens as I clench my teeth together. The last thing I need is a murderous princess following me up the Cloud Mountain. I don't think that would be particularly safe, I say. As the king mentioned, it's a dangerous journey.
That she has taken before, Hiroki cuts in. That we all have. Not all of us,
Koji amends. Hiroki casts an endearing look at his youngest brother, and then turns his pale eyes to the king.
If she goes with him, then at least we can be certain we won't be double-crossed.
I try not to look insulted.
And that way, one of our own will be there when the crystal is finally freed from the depths of the dome, Tetsu says.
Yukiko reclines.
I'm glad you're also eager to get rid of me after just a couple of days in my company.
King Kazu casts a sideways glance to his sister. And then looks at me with a guarded expression.
If you manage to kill the Sea Queen and the Prince's Bane, he says, you'll have to tell the world that we had a hand in it.
It isn't a request. And so I bow my head in agreement, sensing the fragility of the moment. I'm so close that I can almost feel it in the back of my throat like a thirst.
The crystal, the necklace, and the glory.
King Kazu slides back onto his throne with hungry eyes.
I want Pagos to have it all.
I'll tell them whatever you want me to, I say. As long as the Prince's Bane is dead, it won't matter to me. The Pagi's siblings look down at me from their icicle thrones, and, one by one, they smile. When I finally leave the Grand Hall, Lyra is waiting, a foot kicked up against the icicle doors. Her hair is damp from the cold, and she's wearing a thick knitted sweater that dwarfs her spindly wrists. When she sees me, she lets out a breath and pushes herself from the door. What are you doing? I ask. Lyra shrugs.
Just making sure you weren't dead.
I shoot her an unconvinced look. You were eavesdropping. And now? I'm done, she says, and raises her eyebrows as if daring me to do something about it. Before she has a chance to walk away, I make a quick grab for her wrist and pull her back toward me. Lyra whirls around so quickly that her hair splays across her face. She shakes her head to throw it from her eyes, and then looks down at our locked hands, frowning. I want to know what you were thinking before, I say. Threatening to kill a princess in her own kingdom like that, it's not your best attempt at humor. Lyra snatches her hand from mine. Kai thought it was funny. While I'm glad the two of you are bonding, you should try to remember that Kai is an idiot. She smirks. And so are you if you trust the piggies. I don't need to trust anyone. I just need for them to trust me. For a pirate, you're not a very good liar, she says. And you're not very good at bargaining. Everything you've given up seems so vast compared to the nothing you've received in return. It's not nothing. It's to end a war. You really are a child, if you believe it'll be that easy. You think surrendering my kingdom to Princess Yukiko was easy? I ask. It's not just having to marry her, you know. I have to give up every dream I've ever had and stay rooted in duties I've spent my life trying to escape. My hands clench reflexively at my sides as I watch for her reaction. I want Lyra to understand that I didn't just make that deal on a whim, and that every day since I've regretted it. I know the consequences of my actions, and I'm doing everything I can to find a way out. Lyra looks at me wordlessly, and I'm not sure how I expect her to react or if I have the right to expect anything at all. But her silence is more unnerving than anything I could have anticipated. The clock in the Great Hall chimes, marking the beginning of the night winds. Lyra waits a moment until all three bells have cried out, and then, finally, she swallows. The sound is too loud. Are you really going to marry her? She asks, and then shakes her head like she doesn't want to know the answer. It's a smart plan, I suppose, she says. You get the Crystal of Kito and an alliance with a powerful kingdom. Even if you have to give up life on the Saad, you still come out a winner. Her forced smile falters a little at the last part, and when she speaks again, her voice is quiet and severe. You never quite seem to lose, do you, Elian? I'm not sure how to respond to that, since I felt like all I've been doing lately is losing. And this deal with Yukiko is just one more strike in that column. I sigh. And when Lyra pushes her hair from her face, I feel the need to explain my plan. Everything I've orchestrated to escape my deal with Yukiko lingers on the tip of my tongue like an impulse. I know I shouldn't have to defend myself to Lyra or to anyone, but I feel the compulsion to do just that. It won't matter what bargain I've struck when this is over, I say. If I survive, then I have a proposition that Yukiko won't be able to refuse. Don't you think you've done enough proposing? Lyra asks. There's nothing endearing about the way she looks at me now. You're putting your entire kingdom in danger by letting yourself be manipulated by a power-hungry princess who... She breaks off and looks to the floor with an unreadable expression. Lyra, don't. She holds her hand up, keeping the distance between us. You don't owe me anything, especially if it's an explanation. Royalty never owes anyone anything. Her use of the word royalty stings more than it should. I've spent so long trying to escape that as my only marker, and for her to say it with such certainty, as though she's never once seen me as something else, pinches. Always a prince, never just a man. I exhale carefully and shove my hands into my pockets. I never said I owed you anything. Lyra turns. Whether she heard me or not, I can't be sure, but she walks away without looking back, and I don't follow. There's part of me that wants to, a part larger than I'd like to admit, but I wouldn't know what to say if I did. I run a hand through my hair. This night really can't end fast enough. I'm not blind to it. Yukiko steps out from the shadows like a ghost. In the pale torchlight, her eyes look near white. And when she walks closer to me, the glow of the fire smooths the harsh lines of her face until she looks kind, gentle. The light really does play tricks on the mind.
It just doesn't matter to me, she says.
I'm pretty sure that I don't know what you're talking about.
That girl,
Yukiko says.
Lyra.
I suppose she's pretty hard to be blind to.
Yes.
Yukiko's smile burns brighter than the fire.
It's clear you believe that.
I rub my temples, not up for yet another cryptic conversation. Say what it is you have to say, Yukiko. I'm not in the mood for games.
A change from the usual, then, she replies. But I'll grant the request, since you're a guest in my home.
She threads her fingers through her hair and bites down on the corner of her blue lips. The gesture looks far more foreboding than teasing.
You may care about her, Yukiko says, but it won't change anything. Love is not for princes, and it's most certainly not for kings. You promised me that you would become a king, my king. I want to remind you of that promise.
The savage look in Lyra's eyes flashes across my mind. She didn't even give me a second glance before she walked away. The last thing she seemed to want to hear were reasons or explanations. You're letting yourself be manipulated, she said. Royalty never owes anyone anything. But that isn't true. I owe a lot of people a lot of things, and Lyra is no exception. Maybe I don't owe her an explanation, but I do owe her my life. And that seems like the same thing. I shift, and when I realize that's exactly the reaction Yukiko wanted, I glare. I didn't promise you a king, I say. I believe the condition you were sold on was a kingdom. Do you even care which one it is?
That sounds an awful lot like you want to break our deal.
Not break, I say. Renegotiate. Yukiko grins and leans over my shoulder, brushing a cat-like hand against my chest. Her cold breath presses against my neck, and when I turn my head away, I hear the smile in her voice.
So many tricks, she whispers. You'll need sturdier sleeves to hold them all.
34. Lyra. The mountain tip is hidden by its namesake clouds, and a never-ending snowstorm obscures most of its magnitude. Even so, I marvel. I know that long past the sky that hides half of the rock face is an endless peak, a gateway to the stars. The cloud mountain of Pagos is the highest point in the world, farthest from the sea and so furthest from my mother's hold. From mine, if the second eye of Quito really is on this mountain, then it would have been the perfect hiding spot, far from where I could follow until now. My face is covered by layers of thick fabric that obscure everything but my eyes. I itch to pull the cloth and furs from my face, but the cold is more than I can bear, and I dare not let go of the snow poles clenched tightly in my grasp. I'm not even sure I could if I wanted to. My hands feel like they've been frozen into solid fists. We follow the trail up the great mountain for days that turn to weeks, with more silence than I've ever failed to hear from the crew of the Sod. Even Kai, who walks so perfectly in step with Elian, glancing back to Madrid every now and again, to make sure perhaps that she hasn't turned into some kind of frozen sculpture or been blown from the cliff by the brutal winds, remains quiet. Elian is no different. I'm strangely comforted by the fact that it's not just me he doesn't seem to be speaking to. He remains perfectly stoic, following the princess's lead ardently. For some reason, that part is less comforting. I know that marriage is a side effect of royalty. So many things are. Obstacles to content, so cleverly masked as duties. Trials made out to be solutions, and burdens tailored for only the least willing to bear them. All of them. Nothing more than a series of consequences that stem from being heir to a kingdom. Yukiko is Elian's side effect. As the flesh-eater was mine. He traded the map for himself in a noble attempt to salvage his mission by sacrificing his pride. Things like this are expected, predictable, but they're also vexing. I don't know what I expected to achieve when I confronted Elian in the palace, but it wasn't weeks of terse silence. I'm not sure why I even asked about Yukiko. It wasn't why I waited for him while he dealt with the Pagese royals. But I couldn't help myself. Lately it has seemed impossible to try. Maybe that turned out in my favor because my original reason to talk with him, to ask, maybe, if he'd ever considered an alliance, wasn't much better. It was stupid to think I could just walk right up to him and ask if he was willing to forge a peace between our kind. I won't kill you if you don't kill me. It's ridiculous. It's simple for me to consider making a deal with someone who's shown me nothing but loyalty and a way to walk a path I hadn't thought possible before. Free from the shadows of my mother's reign, a new era not determined by death. A delicate peace, even. But how can I expect Elian to do the same when he doesn't even know who I am? When I murdered his friend and countless other princes. When I plotted to murder him. I climb with Elian's back to me, but his face is clear in my mind. As the sky fades to darkness and then the sun climbs higher again, we carry on that way. The farther we get up the mountain, the more I begin to drive myself crazy with thinking, replaying conversations and actions and opportunities. Wondering when I began to feel so utterly human. The sky turns to so many shades of blue that I lose count. It's a quilt of color blending perfectly through the clouds, painting itself like a backdrop for the white glow of the moon and its guiding starlight. "We have to move faster!" Yukiko yells. I can barely hear her voice above the ice winds. "Our next camp is 2 hours ahead, and we need to make it before sundown." Elian pauses and holds out the map, and the storm batters it in his grasp. The edges are crisp with winter, and when his fingers clasp the parchment tighter, trying to keep hold as the wind gathers strength, it splinters. "Sundown is in an hour," Elian yells back. Yukiko's breath clouds between them. "Hence, we need to move faster!" The wind muffles their voices, but even I can hear the sound of Elian's sigh. His shoulders slump a little, and he casts a quick glance to check that we're all still behind him. "It's doable," he calls over to us, though I'm not sure if he's telling us or trying to convince himself. "I'm not sure I can walk without my toes," Kai says.
"Madrid will carry you."
"I don't have toes either, or fingers, actually."
Madrid holds up her gloved hands and whimpers.
"I think I lost a few yesterday."
"At least they'll be well preserved then."
Kai presses his boot into the snow for emphasis.
"If we pick them up on the way down, a healer should be able to stitch them right back on."
Though I can only make out Madrid's eyes, I'm sure she grimaces.
"We don't have time for this," Yukiko says. "Stop wasting your energy and move."
Madrid sticks a snow pole into the ground and pulls her fur mask down. Frost gathers on her lips. "Is that a royal command?" she asks. Yukiko throws back her headdress, and it's like the weather parts for her. She commands the cold, like I once did.
You are in my kingdom, but not in your court, Madrid says.
She wipes her tattooed cheek, where the wind has begun to blister it, and nods to Elian.
Our king is right there. You're forgetting something, aren't you? He's not a king yet.
If the air hadn't already been frozen, I'm sure that last comment would have done it. Kai stiffens, and I see his hand twitch by his side. Quickly, Elian shoots him a sharp glance, and reluctantly, Kai lets his posture relax. Still, his hands keep twitching. I notice that mine do too.
Torek grunts.
He doesn't seem to be able to translate Elian's expressions as well as Kai can. And no sooner does Elian slump in hesitant submission does his first mate lurch violently forward. As Torek approaches Yukiko, I see the threat of his large frame for the first time. No longer is he the gentle giant who watches over the sod. He advances toward the princess, kicking the snow with each heavy footstep.
You little enough!
Elian's voice cuts into Torek's path. He holds out an arm and Torek stops short.
Captain,
he says. I said that's enough. Elian repeats. As usual, his voice betrays nothing but what he wants it to. Perfect calm and indifference. But even from here, I can see his eyes blinking against the storm, like fierce gateways into his heart.
Are we finished now?
Yukiko asks. With every second her blue lips inch higher, mine turn to a snarl beneath my mask. I step forward and pull the cloth from my face. The air bites. Not yet, I say. Yukiko turns her steel gaze to mine. Out of the corner of my eye, I see Elian go suddenly rigid. When Yukiko takes a step toward me, his hand moves slowly to his side. To the knife I know is hidden there.
Is there something else?
Yukiko asks. Many things, I think. The way she looks at Elian being the worst, like she's better than him. Manipulating a prince to get her hands on his kingdom, just as my mother manipulated me to steal mine and extend her reign. Just like I fell into the Sea Queen's trap, Elian is going to fall into Yukiko's. Maybe it was different once, but now I know there's no way I can steal the eye and let my kingdom rise while Elian's crumbles beneath his debt to her. There has to be a way for us both to win this battle. We are not naive little heirs to be molded as they wish. We are warriors. We are rulers.
Elian may not be a king, I tell her, but you're not a queen either, not unless you kill your brothers.
Who has time for murder these days? Yukiko says. Better to just take another kingdom than wait around for this one.
The insinuation is not lost. She thinks she can goad me with the deal she and Elian made. And I suppose she can, because I can't help but hate seeing him stand submissively by her, not giving him a choice in his own future. Using him for her devious plans, just like I intended to. It's too much of a reminder of my life before the sod, before Elian made me realize what it was like to be free. The very person who gave me a glimpse of hope is now so willing to sacrifice his own.
You should be careful, I tell Yukiko.
The thing about taking something that's not yours is that there will always be someone out there ready to take it back.
I suppose I'll have to watch my back then.
No need, I tell her. I can see it perfectly. Yukiko bites down on the corner of her lip, half amused, half curious. When she turns from me, I dare a glance at Elian. There is a dangerous corner to his smile, and I count the seconds while he looks at me, green piercing through the new white of the world, until finally, Kai clasps Elian's shoulder and pushes him onward. When night falls, we set up camp on the flattest part of the mountain, tents stapled into the ground circle a quick fire station. We crowd around it and cook what sparse remnants of food we have left. The cold seems worse when we sit still, so we hover our hands over the fire so closely that we risk getting burnt. The wind wails harder, and the crew warms their throats with the rum Madrid brought in place of more food. When night deepens and the crew's laughter fades to heavy breathing, I listen to the sound of the wind, knowing I won't be able to sleep. Not with the second eye of Quito so close. My mission to overthrow my mother and Elian's fate threaten to intertwine, and I can't close my eyes without thinking about how this war will end. After a while, the snow begins to fall more softly against the tent, and in the dying wind I make out a pair of soft footsteps approaching. I hear them before I see the shadow, drawn on the shelter by the fading glow of my lantern. When the door unzips, I'm not at all surprised to see Elian crouching beside it. "Come with me," he says. And so I do. I've never seen the stars, not the way Elian has. There are so many things I haven't done. Experiences Elian seems to have that nobody else, especially me, could dream of. The stars are one of them. They're Elian's in a way that they're no one else's. Elian doesn't just look at the stars, but he imagines them too. He draws pictures of them in his mind, creating stories about gods and wars and the souls of explorers. He thinks about where his soul will go when he dies, and if he will become part of the night. All of this he tells me at the height of the Cloud Mountain, with the moon and the wind and the empty space of the world before us. The crew is sleeping, along with the Peggy's princess. It feels like the entire world is asleep. And us, just us, we are finally awake.
"I've never shown this to anybody," Elian says.
He doesn't mean the stars, but the way he sees them. They are his secret, just like the ocean is mine, and when he speaks of them, his smile is as bright as they are. I wonder if I've ever had that look. If it glittered in my eyes when I thought of home, washing over me like a wave and transforming me as I was so easily transformed before. I think there are a lot of things you haven't shown anybody. We don't talk about Yukiko, or the marriage that seems as impending as our war. We don't do anything but pretend there's something other than darkness and choices woven from the nightmare ahead of us both. Elian takes in a breath. His hand lingers beside mine.
"I had this idea that when I found the crystal, I would feel something," he says.
"Victorious?"
"Peaceful. But we're so close, and I feel the complete opposite. It's like I'm dreading the moment we open that dome."
Something shifts in my chest. Hope, maybe?
"Why?"
Elian doesn't reply, and that's enough of an answer. Despite everything, he doesn't want to be responsible for destroying an entire race, no matter how evil he thinks we are. I want to tell him that I feel it too. The sense of dread mingling with the pull of duty. I want to tell him that we weren't all born monsters. The second eye of Quito could destroy either one of us, and neither of us seems to want to be the one to wield it. I toy with the idea of revealing the truth to him, like maybe it will sway him over to my side as he has seemed to sway me over to his. But it seems like more of a fairy tale than the eye ever has been. Because if I tell Elian who I am, he'll never accept it. I could promise I've changed, or not changed, but changed back, to who I was and could have been if not for my mother. This humanity has transformed me in a way that is so much deeper than fins for legs and scales for skin. I'm as different on the inside now
as I am on the outside. I feel the horror of what I've done and the overwhelming desire to begin again, to become the kind of queen I think Crestel always wanted me to be. I turn to Elian, letting the snow wet my cheek. You once asked me to tell you something about the sirens you didn't know, I say. There's a legend among them that warns of what can happen if a human were to take a siren's heart.
I've never heard it.
That's because you're not a siren.
Neither are you,
Elian says, matching my wry tone. I give him a hollow smirk and continue on. They say that if any human were to get a hold of a siren's heart, then they would be forever immune to the effects of the song. Elian arches a cynical eyebrow.
Immunity from a dead siren's song?
From any siren's song. I don't know why I'm telling him, save for the hope that if this war can't end, then the least he can do is survive it, or stand some kind of a chance. According to the stories, I say, the reason sirens dissolve so quickly into foam when they die is to prevent such a thing from happening. Elian considers this.
And you think that's possible?
He asks.
If I somehow manage to cut out a siren's heart before she melts away, then I'll suddenly be able to face any siren without needing to worry about falling under their enchantments.
I suppose it won't matter, I tell him, if you plan to kill them all anyway. Elian's eyes lose a little light.
I think I understand why the original families didn't use the crystal back when it was first crafted, he says. A genocide doesn't seem quite right, does it? Maybe once we kill the Sea Queen, it will be enough. They might all stop. Maybe even the Prince's Bane will stop.
I turn back to the sky, and quietly I ask, do you really believe killers can stop being killers?
I want to.
His voice sounds so far from the confident prince I met all that time ago. He's not the man who commands a ship, or the boy born to command an empire. He is both, and neither. He is something that exists in the in-between, where only I can see. A slip in the world where he is trapped. The thought lights something inside of me. I steal my gaze from the stars and turn to him, my cheek damp on the snow-soaked blanket. Elian is so much like the waters he plunders. Still and peaceful on the surface, but beneath there is madness. What if I were to tell you a secret? I ask. Elian turns to me, and suddenly just looking at him hurts. A dangerous longing wells, and I dare myself to tell him over and over in my mind, reveal the truth and see if humans are as capable of forgiveness as they are of vengeance.
What if you were?
It would change how you saw me. Elian shrugs.
Then don't tell me.
I roll my eyes. What if you need to know?
People don't tell secrets because someone needs to know them. They do it because they need someone to tell.
I swallow. My heart feels loud enough to hear. I'll ask you something instead, then.
To keep a secret?
To keep a favor. Elian nods. And I forget that we're murderers and enemies, and when my identity is revealed, he might very well try to kill me. I don't think of Yukiko claiming him like a prize she doesn't know the value of. And I don't think of the Sea Queen or the notion of betrayal. I think of my human heart, suddenly beating so fast, too fast, and the crease between Elian's eyebrows as he waits for my answer. Are you ever going to kiss me? Slowly, Elian says,
that's not a favor.
His hand moves from beside mine, and I feel a sudden absence, and then it's on my cheek, cupping my face, thumb stroking my lip. It feels like the worst thing I've ever done,
and the best thing I could ever do, and how strange that the two are suddenly the same. How strange that instead of taking his heart, I'm hoping he takes mine.
Do you remember when we first met?
He asks. You said I was more charming when I was unconscious. Elian laughs, and he's so close that I feel his body shake against mine. I can see every scar and freckle of his skin, every streak of color in his eyes. I lick my lips. I can almost taste him.
Ask me again,
he says. His forehead presses against mine, breath ragged on my lips. I close my eyes and breathe him in. Licorice and ocean salt, and if I move, if I breathe, then whatever fragile thing it is between us will disappear with the wind. Just do it already, I say. And he does. 35. Lyra. The path ends in water, just as it began. With Yukiko as our guide navigating us up her sacred route, we slice our journey in half, never lost or wavering. She leads us to camps with quick fires bright enough to burn a hole through the mountain itself, and up paths that cut as much through time as they do the mountain. Quicker routes, faster courses, trails littered with cheats. Technology that sometimes even carries us part of the way. It's not a surprise that the Pagies' royalty are able to survive the climb with so many tricks at their disposal. It's also not a surprise that anyone not from their bloodline doesn't survive. Though I hate to find any common ground with the likes of Yukiko, even I have to admit that her family's scam is clever. Using everything they can to perpetuate the legend of their origins, ensuring the loyalty of their people through awe alone, if nothing else. It's not a bad hand to play, like Elian and his golden blood, or me and Kito's deadly power, though in my case the legend happens to be true. I stop dead, and the rest of the crew stills alongside me. Elian's gloved hand hovers dangerously close to mine, and though I feel the air spark and warm between us, I don't look at him. I can't. I can only stare ahead, my feet burying themselves farther into the snow the longer I stay still. But I can't move either. Ahead, there are wonders. There is the palace, carved from the last breaths of my goddess, Kito. Though we're no more than 500 feet from the peak of the mountain, we find ourselves at the base of a great canyon, surrounded by chutes of falling water that crash onto a pile of black rocks. They look like the remnants of a landslide, and when the water thrashes against them, it creates mounds of steam that hisses as it rises, before finally dissipating into the clouds. Amid the froth, the rocks float aimlessly on the edges of a great moat, like borders to keep the miraculously unfrozen water inside. In the center, surrounded by island tufts of snow, is the palace. It's an iceberg that towers to the height of the waterfalls, with windows made from solid wind and ornate steeples that curve and protrude at awkward angles. It is a body of sculpted snow, a fortress of slants and edges that eclipse the glory of the mountain itself. A broken path of ice leads to the palace, but it is too fragmented and unstable to ensure safe passage for an army of 100. Instead, we find a batch of large rowboats secured on the outskirts of the moat, where it is at its calmest, farthest from the three sides of the falling water surrounding us. We split ourselves between the vessels and row toward the mouth of the palace, our boat pushed half by Torek's strength and half by the great gusts of wind that propel us forward in a crooked line. When we dismount, the palace is leagues above us, and I have to arch my back just to get a good enough look. But there's no time to take it in or wonder how it's possible that a palace built from snowstorms can seem somehow warmer a degree or two above the rest of the Cloud Mountain. Yukiko powers ahead with purpose, and we follow her into the depths of the iceberg, using her torchlight to guide us when she walks too fast for us to keep pace. The walls gleam like halls of mirrors, so that suddenly our numbers are doubled, tripled. All I see are faces and tufts of breath that mingle among us like fog. We can't help but linger a little behind, walking slower as we try to decipher what is a reflection and what is actually Yukiko. When we fall too far behind and she rounds a corner much too far ahead, we're forced into a fleeting darkness. Elian's hand finds mine. He squeezes just once and everything in me quickens, heats. My body curves toward him and I press my free hand to the glacier walls. When we find the curve to the corner, Yukiko's light illuminates our faces once more. I don't drop Elian's hand. Yukiko pauses at a large ice wall that shines against the heat of her flame, echoing our faces back to us. She hooks the torch onto a small brace and takes a step back. We're here, she says. Elian gives me a quick glance and then unhooks the key from his neck and hands it to Yukiko. His eyes are impatient as Yukiko holds it up against a concave in the wall. The dip mirrors the patterns on the necklace perfectly. From every ornate swirl to its fanged encasing. It's the perfect lock for our key, and when Yukiko presses the necklace to the wall, it clicks securely into place. Snow drops from the ceiling and runs from the walls like water. There's a heavy groan, and then the thick pane of ice heaves itself backward and reveals a cavern too large to be housed inside this moderate palace. Elian enters like the thirsty explorer. I follow quickly behind him, paying no mind to the princess I brush past. Everywhere is blue. Thick trunks of frost press against the ceiling and then drop back down in leafy tufts. They stem from the walls like branches, veins of ice paving the floor in roots. It's a forest of snow and ice. The crew swaggers slowly in and gazes around in wide-eyed wonder. The cavern is truly a place of beauty, a place touched by Kito. But Elian doesn't marvel at his surroundings. He stares resolutely ahead at the center of the dome. A steeple of ocean water floats in a perfect mixture of emerald and sapphire, and I recognize it instantly as water from the Diavolos Sea, from my home. In the heart of it is the second eye of Kito. It's like nothing I have ever seen. Even the eye of the Sea Queen's trident doesn't quite compare, with its form so roughly slashed into shape and its color dimmed from the decades underwater. This stone is unaffected by any of that. Crafted into a perfectly geometric circle. It is tinged with the florid eyes of my mother and the gallons of blood spilled in its name. The steeple that houses it is a solid ice sculpture. But when Elian reaches out to touch it, he doesn't recoil. It's not frozen, but suspended in time, in place.
We can't melt it, then, Elian says.
We can't break it, Yukiko urges. It might shatter the crystal. He turns to her.
I doubt we could break it anyway. It even feels impenetrable.
Yukiko shakes her head furiously. We have to open it, she says. The ritual, what is it? All eyes turn to me, and I take in a breath, readying myself. This is the moment I've been working toward. The very thing I maneuvered myself back onto Elian's ship to do. I look at him, and how his hair curls by his ears, sticking up in a way that shows every moment he slept in a damp tent. The frown that pulses down to his jaw. The ridiculous smell of licorice whenever he sighs. I am too close. I clear my throat. Siren blood, I say. Elian turns to me.
What?
Do you think just anyone can wield the crystal of Keto? I ask. It has to be a warrior worthy of its magic.
A warrior,
he says. A siren killer. Lies and lies, all mingling with half-truths on my tongue. Kai throws his hands up in the air and stalks forward.
Where are we supposed to get siren blood? He asks. Why would you wait until now to tell us that?
It wouldn't make a difference when she told us, Madrid says, staring at me with an unreadable expression. Sirens don't have blood. They have acid. We can't capture that if they turn to sea foam, and even if we did, it would eat through anything we put it in.
Your knife, I point to Elian's belt. The only thing on this earth that can carry the blood of a siren.
It doesn't carry it, Elian says. It drinks it.
Absorbs it, I correct. Don't tell me you haven't noticed that with every siren you kill, it feels a little stronger. A little heavier?
Elian stays silent.
How would you know?
Yukiko tilts her face to the side.
There's something about you I can't quite settle on.
I ignore her and keep my focus on Elian. His eyebrows crease, and I know in that moment he doubts me. That even if I'm ignoring Yukiko, he isn't. He's suspicious. Perhaps he always was. And though he has every right to be, and part of me is proud of him for it, it hurts all the same. I cannot be trusted, and it kills me that he might know that. All the same, I can't let him be the one to free the eye. I give him a carefree smile. I told you that I would be useful to keep around.
Elian pulls the knife from his belt and holds it up to the cavern light. He twists the blade in his hand and takes a step toward me.
I consider backing away, but stay rooted in place. Retreating now will only make me look guilty.
Well?
I ask.
Well, nothing, he says. I believe in you.
He pauses a beat, as though waiting for me to contradict this and tell him that it's a mistake. Even more ridiculous is that I want to. I have the urge to tell him that he should never do something as stupid as believing in me. But I say nothing, and so Elian turns to the frozen waters of Diavolos and plunges his knife into the center. I was supposed to be happy when it failed. The blood inside the knife is long gone, drunk and swapped into magic that kept it invincible and allowed it to absorb the life of a siren. I knew this, but I gave Elian hope, because that's what liars do when they don't want to get caught. And I had to let them think I believed the knife would work, because why else would I have waited until now to tell them blood was the key? I had to let Elian fail, so I can succeed. I just wasn't supposed to feel so bad about it. Hours have passed, and I'm sure it must be night. Either way, the crew is sleeping in various small chambers outside the dome. Sentries and trespassers. They're determined not to leave until they find a way of freeing the eye. If Elian's resolve wasn't enough, Yukiko's fury would have kept them all there anyway.
Try, she said. Try leaving without the glory you promised my brother.
I grip the lightweight sword and stare down at the second eye of Keto, suspended in the water of my home. Against my skin, the seashell necklace calls out. It yearns to be reunited with the powerful sea that created it. I can feel it too. The steady pull of Diavolos stretching out its arms to jerk me into its wake. I grip my sword and slice it clean across my palm.
I'm indifferent as blood dribbles down my arm and drops into the eye. There's no scorching pain or endless acid cold. It's warm and red, and so very human.